African-American Religion, next on Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Join me now for a discussion about a new documentary history of African-American religion. My guests are Albert Rabiteau of Princeton University and David Wills of Amherst College.
Well, African-American religion emerges out of an encounter of Africans and Europeans, and both the Africans involved and the Europeans involved are very diverse groups of people, where, for example, an African population outnumbers a European population, there's likely to be a greater persistence of certain types of overtly African religious patterns, where you scatter a handful of Africans among an overwhelmingly predominant body of Europeans, you are less likely to see an obvious continuity with African traditions. So the possible outcomes are very diverse.
David Wills of Amherst College. He'll be back in just a moment with Albert Rabiteau of Princeton University to talk about their new documentary history of African-American religion. Partial support for this program comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center. The state of Florida recently passed legislation requiring public schools to teach certain subjects, among them Black history. While the educational results of such a strategy are open to debate, one thing seems clear, namely that African American scholarship itself has flowered over the last quarter century. This scholarship now embraces important new approaches to African American religion. As a consequence, much of the research of scholars who worked earlier in this century has come in for spirited reconsideration. An example is Carter G. Woodson's classic study, The History of the Negro Church. The title alone, by today's inclusive standards, has a kind of quaint ring to it. Yet, according to the co-editors of a new documentary history of African American religion, Carter G. Woodson was a pioneer whose writing remains important as a starting point for contemporary scholars. Albert Rabiteau and David Wills are historians of religion. Albert Rabiteau teaches at Princeton University, David Wills at Amherst College. The goal of their project is a three-volume narrative and documentary history of African-American religion, from its origins in the Atlantic world through our own contemporary period. We begin with an overview of how the study of African-American religious belief and practice has evolved during the 20th century. Here is Albert Rabiteau.
Well, Woodson's classic and pioneering history of the Negro Church really focuses pretty much on what the title says, the church. Since that time, the scholarship has broadened to include religious life outside of the church, which sometimes is called folk religion, aspects of religious behavior that would involve magic or conjure, medicine. Also, even within the church, the story of people in the pews, not just of the pastors in the pulpit, have come in for more focus.
What about gender? That's an element that enters into your considerations, does it not, Al? I mean, you're paying attention to women after a fashion.
It does, and one of the aspects of women's religious experience, which is very important for understanding Black religious experience in general, since for much of the history of Black Americans, the culture has been primarily oral rather than written, is the whole area of performance, of music and singing. So one might, in trying to understand not only the Afro-American experience, but that experience as gendered, is to look at the tremendous role, for example, of the very powerful woman gospel singer. People like Mahalia Jackson readily come to mind. Mm-hmm. The whole performance aspect of African-American religion has been underlooked to some to a large extent.
Well, it didn't get any respect. I mean, it was something that scholars would look at and say, "Look, we don't really pay attention to this kind of thing. It's anecdotal, apocryphal. It's too detailed. It's trivial." And now, all of a sudden, you're looking at it seriously.
That's true. And other dimensions that would be seen more in the realm of the women's roles within religion, such as healing, which has often had a religious component. Midwifery, which has also involved a religious component, and traditions such as making of quilts and other aspects of African-American culture.
Let me add something to what Al's just said from a different direction, and that is Woodson himself was deeply versed in the archival resources for the study of the Black Church, but he himself could not fully exploit the range of things that are available. People sometimes aren't aware that in the 19th century, for example, the independent Black churches began to publish their own newspapers, print church records. Church leaders kept diaries and sources of that nature. So especially going back to around the 1800, there's a great deal of material. We know, for example, even though we have only fragmentary documentation of it, that groups of Black women were formed in the context of the evangelical revivals of the 1740s.
Are we talking about history or theology when we try to understand what has happened to African Americans in the New World and we speak of religious belief? Al?
Well, let me try to answer that, Wayne, by telling a brief story, if I can. Once upon a time, Nancy Kokorufu, the great spider of the Ashanti legends, became concerned about the wisdom in the world because people had become careless of wisdom and entirely too much wisdom was being lost. Therefore, Nancy Kokorufu decided that he would take all the wisdom of the world, collect it, and store it at the top of a tall palm tree for safekeeping. So sure enough, with great effort, he collected all the wisdom of the world and put it in a huge gourd, which he tied to his chest, and he began to climb the palm tree. Now, as he climbed the palm tree, he began to experience difficulties. It was a tall palm tree. The weather was hot. It was a very hot day. He was tired from all his collections. To top it all off, his young son, Nicotia, at the bottom of the tree, shouted up to him, "Father, if you indeed had all the wisdom of the world up there with you, you would have tied that gourd on your back." This was too much for Anansi Kokorufu. In a fit of anger, he untied the gourd, hurled it towards the ground. It smashed, scattering into 1,000 pieces, and all the wisdom of the world was scattered on the earth. By this time, people had learned their lesson, and they came, and with their own gourds, gathered up all the wisdom of the world. Now, this is why it is that to this very day, there are some people who have a lot of wisdom, some people who have little, and some who have none at all. Now, the point of my story is that I think talking about this tradition as this historical traditions as containing wisdom, and this would apply very much to the way in which we teach religion in high schools and in colleges, is that we need to get in touch with the wisdom of the ancestors. And ancestors here, broadly conceived, ancestors from many cultures, from many races, that we as human beings cannot afford to lose any of the wisdom. And especially we as human beings cannot afford to think that any one people or any one culture has all of the wisdom of the world up there with them.
Now that sounds to me, David Wills, like an eloquent defense of what we call multiculturalism, and yet its critics will tell us that multiculturalism is a kind of therapeutic thing, that we just sort of, it's a balm that we put on our understanding of race relations. In this instance, we're talking about African-American history and religion. What about this? Do you go into class and teach this as a way to advance harmonious race relations, or do you come to it as a historian, cold and dispassionate?
I don't think I want to make quite that choice, Wayne. I mean, it doesn't seem to me that one has to. This subject requires as much historical rigor and care and concern about objectivity as any other subject does. But just because one goes at it with scholarly care doesn't mean that one is indifferent to the consequences of what one is doing. Indeed, by the very act of trying to give a careful, attentive reading to a wide range of traditions, one can do both of these things. One both honors one's calling as a scholar and also tries to promote among people a genuine empathy and sympathy for one another's traditions.
Gentlemen, let me follow that with another large order. One of the missing elements in the doing of Black religion, the history of Black religion in the United States, is the whole question of the sources, the African sources. I'm looking at you wide-eyed here. How could something so important not really come to the fore for you scholars?
Well, it was hard to find because, again, many of the sources were textual sources. Unfortunately, there weren't any videotapes back then when Africans arrived off the ships. to give us some sense of what may have been going on that was not described by the white missionary accounts or planters' accounts.
In other words, who kept the records? That's the point.
That's true, but we do know that Africans didn't arrive as so many blank slates waiting to be written on by the culture of the Euro-Americans. They came with their own culture. Culture isn't like baggage that can be disallowed before you board ship. It travels in the minds, the hearts, and the memories of people. Mm-hmm. And African cultures were transmitted by slaves to their descendants. The African slave trade should be seen then not only as a rupture, but it should also be seen as a diaspora, that is, as the spread of African cultures across the Atlantic.
Is it fair to say, David Wills, that African-American religion originates on its own terms, or does it have to be shaped by and in effect become a reflection of the culture that helps to create it? That is to say, the North American mainland or the Caribbean, for example.
Well, African-American religion emerges out of an encounter of Africans and Europeans, and both the Africans involved and the Europeans involved are very diverse groups of people. So the kind of result you will get depends upon which sort of Africans and which sort of Europeans meet in what kind of context. Mm-hmm. Where, for example, an African population outnumbers a European population, there's likely to be a greater persistence of certain types of overtly African religious patterns. Where you scatter a handful of Africans among an overwhelmingly predominant body of Europeans, you are less likely to see an obvious continuity with African traditions. So mm-hmm. the possible outcomes are very diverse.
Al Rabiteau, let me turn to you, and let's put some controversial elements on the table here. We're talking about your documentary history of African-American religion. What about things like Cuban Santeria? Cults, is that a proper word to use here?
It is not. Cuban Santeria and Haitian Vodou are ancient religions that are African-based and that have a great deal of wisdom and insight into the human condition, which is why they have lasted for so many years under severe prescription.
So they take a bad rap from the press in this country?
They certainly do, yes, uh-huh. A very culturally biased rap. And these are religions that have attracted and continue to attract thousands of followers, and they've migrated now to most of the major cities of the United States. If I can only give you one illustration of the way in which these ancient religions have entered into the modern world. One of my favorite stories is about the priest of one of the Yoruba gods from Nigeria, Oshun, who lived actually in New York City, and some Cuban migrants in Miami wanted to have a service for Oshun but didn't know the proper order of service. So they flew the priest down from New York City. He came down with a copy of the service Xeroxed in Yoruba and Spanish, and the service was held. So these religions have entered the modern world.
Talk about a combination of the very old and the very new, am I right?
Right.
It's important to realize in the United States that our sense of our past must change as we change. That is, who we are determines what our past is. And as we have increasing number of immigrants from the Caribbean and from Hispanic America generally as well, it's important to see that the whole past of those regions becomes part of the American past, the North American past, in a new way. You know, often people who study the history of the United States and trace the origins of the country back into the colonial period have a very narrow focus on British North America, and they don't really pay attention to the fact that even British North America in the colonial period was linked very closely to the British Caribbean. So in some ways, this 20th century resurfacing of Afro-Caribbean religions is a reminder of a previous phase in our history when we have closer ties to the Caribbean than we have now, than we had in between in the 19th century.
Well, this is another way, David Wills, of saying that we need to look, for example, at the American South and, as you say, the Caribbean, in addition to New England and the white Puritans who were doing religion in the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries.
Absolutely. It's very common in telling the story of religion in America to focus the plot on two themes. One, the history of Puritanism, and secondly, the history of religious pluralism in America. And the folks who do that usually trace the history of Puritanism, obviously enough, back to New England, and see the roots of our religious pluralism in the middle colonies. What they leave out of account is the South. Mm-hmm. I would argue that the central religious theme of Southern history during the colonial period is the religious encounter of blacks and whites, and we are all of us today the heirs of that theme, as much as we're the heirs of the developing history of religious pluralism and the ongoing legacy of Puritanism.
Does that mean, Al Rabiteau, that we have to wait until, what, almost the end of the 19th century and into the 20th century before we see the ways that African-American religious belief and practice begins to have an effect on white Christianity in this country?
Well, one could see those effects way back at the turn of the 18th century, that is the move from the late 1700s to the early 1800s. And interestingly enough, that point in time makes an interesting comparison with the turn to the 20th century that you just spoke of.
How is that?
At the turn of the 18th century, the turn of the 19th century, there was a moment of great reciprocity in the early evangelical revivals between black evangelicals and white evangelicals. And that moment of reciprocity, of even biracial fellowship, really foundered on the rock of slavery. At the turn of the 20th century, there was a moment of strong biracial fellowship between Pentecostal and holiness, black and white Christians. And that early moment of fellowship also foundered not on the rock of slavery, but on the rock of racism.
Isn't this an incredible irony? I mean, our subject is love and compassion and charity and a belief in God, and yet the color line, in the phrase of one of our distinguished Americans, African Americans, is the thing that separates us. That's the thing that prevents a complete understanding and harmony.
Well, that's one of the key tests as to whether this experiment that America is will succeed or will fail.
Al Rabiteau and David Wills, we're talking about your African American Religion, a documentary history project. That's the large title for the project you two are involved in. Al, you got any favorite stories, anecdotes that have come out of this scholarship?
Well, one of the most moving stories for me, which is not a pleasant one, it's a tragic one, is the raid upon an African fishing village that occurred in 1444 when Portuguese explorers sailing down the coasts of West Africa raided a fishing village one morning and took over 200 captives and brought them back to Lagos in Portugal, divided them up on a field, and sold them as slaves. And one of the observers, the man who actually recorded this event, broke into tears when he saw the human tragedy involved. But he immediately, in his chronicle, backed away from his human sympathy and said that for a moment I forgot myself, and then my Christian conscience came to the fore, and I realized that these people, though now slaved, would be in a much better situation because they would have the opportunity to be Christianized.
This reminds me of that wonderful line in Huck Finn. Mark Twain says that Huckleberry Finn has a sound heart and a deformed conscience. He's being dictated to by the constraints of his society, whereas his heart tells him to do something else when in his dealings with the runaway slave Jim.
That's true, and too often the history of race relations has been marked by failures to respond to the natural sympathy of the human heart.
David Wills, let me turn to you. Any stories that come to mind after all of these millions of pages that you've been through?
That's just it, Wayne. You get me telling stories, and I won't know where to stop. It's and I think that's an important point. The human richness and complexity of this story is in some ways the story. There really is a recurrent, a persistent tendency to reduce images of blacks in the world to a few stock stereotypical figures. And one thing that we have discovered over and over again, that the twists and turns of this story, the complexities of what happens, the rich array and the cast of characters that one finds in the broad history of African American religion, it's overwhelming. And I really do mean it. I wouldn't know where to stop if I started telling you my favorite anecdotes.
Well, you told me, you mentioned before our taping session, that there is an arithmetical and a geometrical component here. The closer you come to the end of this project, the farther away you are from it.
Well, that's true in the sense that the more we learn, the more we see needs to be studied and presented. So that our aspirations of what we want to do advance geometrically, it seems, and our ability to cover the subject moves arithmetically. So as I have sometimes remarked, it often feels that we're every day we're a little further from being finished.
Al, let me turn to you. How does the kind of project that you and David Wills and other scholars are involved in, is that going to increase our understanding of how African Americans live and behave and move in our modern American society today?
I think it will, Wayne, but not in any immediately direct and simplistic way. History is often looked to as an explanatory device for where we are in the present, and that only works to a certain extent. I think that one of the things that our project will help us to understand is a sense of the rich humanity of black people and the wisdom that comes out of the traditions of religious experience, varied traditions of religious experience that black people have lived over the centuries of their world encounters with other peoples.
It's important to understand that the study of African-American religion is not simply a study of institutions or how people have coped or managed. In fact, a whole lot of black history is often about social or political strategies for survival, and that's terribly important, but it's not the whole story. Equally important is the question of how people have made sense of the world in which they found themselves. So that the whole experience of American slavery and racism is not only a practical problem that people had to deal with on a day-to-day basis, it's a religious problem of a very weighty sort in that it raises a question of what sort of world is this in which these kinds of things can happen? How do I account for the world and my experience in it? And one of the core things that the study of African American religious history is just exactly the tracing of the responses to that question.
Mm-hmm. Al, you want to add a comment to that?
Well, I would add simply that out of that wrestling with the question of meaning has come a tradition that has shaped the experience and the meaning of this country. That one can take an image, for example, like the Exodus image, mm-hmm. which has been so powerful in the history of how Americans have thought of one another. But if one thinks about it from the perspective of African Americans, that image becomes inverted. That is, the trip across the Atlantic was not a trip from freedom, from slavery into freedom, was not a trip across the Red Sea. Rather, it was the reverse. It was a trip into slavery. And as long as African Americans were enslaved, and as long as African Americans remain oppressed by the larger society, then America has not yet lived up to its promise to be a promised land. And that's, I think, a very important lesson that comes out of this struggle for meaning, a lesson for all of us.
David Wills, Al Rabiteau, let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation. Let me get real personal with you two scholars. Does it make any difference that you guys believe that you are practicing a religious faith in any sense? What's the interplay between your personal lives and your work as scholars and historians? Al, can I begin with you?
Well, I, as a historian, believe that questions of my own belief, I attempt to bracket. That is, if a student asks me, do I believe, are there African gods in reality?
Right.
That's a question that I myself am not prepared to answer in the classroom. And indeed, my beliefs about that are not important. What's important is what the people whom you are studying believe. However, I also believe in having bracketing that belief also involves a kind of empathy. That is, that one does not attack or attempt to explain away the beliefs of others, but attempts to appreciate those. Now, it's through that empathy that I believe my studies then have an impact upon my own belief and my mm-hmm. own sense of my own humanity.
Fair enough. David, I'll give you the last word.
Well, the great German sociologist and political theorist and General scholar Max Weber once described himself as religiously unmusical. It's often the case that I think...
Musically challenged, religiously challenged.
I think it's often the case that people who are, in their own eyes, religiously unmusical, that is, who regard religion as a kind of strange phenomenon to which they have themselves no personal connection, are driven above all by the question of how do we explain this curious behavior. And it tends to put the scholar in the position of standing above his or her subject matter and explaining the behavior better than the people could explain it themselves. I think when one has religious convictions of one's own, even in studying different religious groups, one does not have this sense that they have to be explained or explained away, but as Al says, there's an empathy that shapes one's treatment of them.
Albert Rabiteau teaches at Princeton University, David Wills at Amherst College. Rabiteau and Wills are historians of religion and the chief editors of a new documentary history of African-American religious belief and practice. Stay tuned for information about writing for a cassette tape of this discussion. You're listening to Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. My guests this week were Albert Rabiteau and David Wills, historians of religion, respectively at Princeton University and Amherst College. For an audio tape of this discussion, send $10 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 717. That's program number 717, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code again is 27709. Next week on Soundings, join me for a conversation about religion and nationalism. My guest will be the distinguished Irish statesman and scholar Conor Cruise O'Brien. Conor Cruise O'Brien will be here to discuss Godland, his book about religion and nationalism in the ancient and modern worlds. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Partial support for this program came from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.